Rolling.
This is the FedSoc Films Podcast,
where we continue the conversation sparked on film.
You want to know what freedom tastes like? It tastes like this beer.
Take one.
This is, in fact, the classic solution in search of a problem.
Action.
That cannot help but be controversial.
Cut.
With expert discussion and analysis.
With the greatest legal minds on the topic today. The FedSoc Films Podcast.
It's a wrap.
Welcome to the FedSoc Films Podcast. This episode is all about the film, The Philosophers Behind the Founders. Who are some of the other philosophers behind the founders that didn't make it into our film? Today we have two professors from the film, Paul Carice and Michael Zuckert, who are here to answer that question and tell us about thinkers like Blackstone, Hobbes, and Machiavelli who influenced the American founding. So, other than Locke and Montesquieu, who are the most prominent philosophers behind the founders, who are the other philosophers behind the founders? Are there other philosophers maybe, you know, lingering in the shadows of the thoughts of our founding fathers?
One of the people who definitely has to be mentioned is William Blackstone. William Blackstone was the first professor of the common law in an English university, and he wrote this very famous commentaries on the laws of England, which was the major textbook for a lot of the early Americans as they learned English law. But Blackstone was somebody who was extraordinarily influenced by both Locke and Montesquieu. If you were to read his book in all the more theoretical parts, you'll see that those two figures figure so prominently in his work. And Blackstone was an authority for the founders, especially with regard to, Blackstone was important, I would argue, for one very special reason. As opposed to the French, when they made their revolution, the Americans did not feel the need to reject their whole legal and political past. They were able to affirm it. And one of the reasons why, at least in my opinion, is that Blackstone had argued that the principles of the common law, that is the established English legal reality, which the American colonists shared in, that was perfectly consistent with the political philosophic positions that the Americans were adopting of Locke and Montesquieu. And that made the Americans feel like they didn't need to start the world completely over again. They had a great sense that they were producing a new beginning, but not everything. They didn't have to throw out everything. And that made the American Revolution so much more successful than the French Revolution had been. So Blackstone, they used him for getting legal details of a lot of things. So, for example, when they came to understand, well, what exactly does the executive power consist of? Blackstone was very helpful to them. They didn't copy him exactly, but they took a lot of things from him. When they wanted to understand how Parliament worked, they learned a lot of that from Blackstone. So Blackstone, very useful. But I would say this overall contribution of showing the way in which their past traditions and their past practice could be assimilated with their new philosophic orientation was probably the most important. Paul, you agree with that?
Yes, and the Americans see Blackstone as this blend of Locke's philosophy and Montesquieu's philosophy in a way, because from Locke, there's such a strong emphasis in Blackstone on rights, and including a right we haven't talked about so much in Locke's philosophy of right of property. But also the larger spirit, so to speak, of Blackstone's commentaries is Montesquieu, and just in the way Michael mentioned, that there doesn't need to be a radical rethinking of the culture, political and constitutional and legal, of the American colonies, now independent states. We can take the English common law, constitutional culture, and adapt it. We can be sort of gradual and reforming, which is very much the spirit of Montesquieu's political philosophy, to be wary of being completely radical. So there's this odd thing about the American Revolution. It's the moderate revolution. It's the conservative revolution, certainly when you compare it to, as Michael mentioned, the French Revolution, but later the Russian Revolution, China. And its revolution, it's less radical. It is obviously a radical thing in one sense to be declaring independence, fighting a war of revolution, But the Americans don't start over from scratch. They adapt, they gradually reform. And so these two figures, Montesquieu and Blackstone, are very important for seeing that quality of the American Revolution. But we should mention a more radical philosopher, so to speak, interpreted as a radical philosopher, Hobbes, which fits with this, that the leading American statesmen we've been mentioning, Jefferson and Adams and Madison and Hamilton and others, they know of Hobbes, but they do not speak fondly of him, Michael.
For sure not. Hobbes and Machiavelli were the two figures from the history of philosophy that they were almost uniformly, they would almost uniformly appeal to as what they were not wanting to be, who they were not willing to follow. Although that's got to be qualified a little bit in the case of Machiavelli, because there were some who were a bit more influenced by Machiavelli. And I think in some way, some of them were more influenced by Machiavelli than they let on. But Hobbes, for sure, Locke spoke at one time of that justly decried Hobbes, and the Americans, for the most part, saw him exactly in that way. What do you think was, what was it about Hobbes that got them off? What do you think was there?
Well, one famous instance is a letter that Alexander Hamilton writes in 1775. So the particular context is Hamilton defending the spirit of revolution or claims for independence growing by citing the natural rights philosophy of Locke and Montesquieu and Burlamaquis, and explicitly contrasting this to the person he's writing against, Reverend Seabury. He says, "You sound a lot like Hobbes, this view that the sovereign power should have absolute control in order to maintain order in society. And we Americans repudiate that. You should go read your Locke and your Montesquieu and your Burlamaquis." So that's a letter called The Farmer Refuted from Hamilton in 1775.
Yeah. One of the interesting people of the era who has a remarkably small presence actually in the thinking of the Americans, I think, was Rousseau, who had been himself very influenced by Montesquieu, but the Americans occasionally mention him. His book, The Emile, which is a book on education, had some influence on American thinking about education. But his major political works, The Social Contract, for example, did not have much presence in American thinking, which is sometimes a surprise because we like to think that the tradition that Jefferson stands for had some Rousseauian strains, but we don't see much evidence that Jefferson even really knew the thought of Rousseau. Occasionally, Madison will mention Rousseau, but he was remarkably not present for the Americans, so in my opinion, kind of strangely, but that may have had partly to do with who could read French and how many translations were available. One of the interesting things, of course, is that Montesquieu was as influential as he was because there was an English translation of Montesquieu made very early, which had a big impact. That translation, as opposed to the original French text, had a big impact in America.
And so Rousseau is much more influential in intellectual life and beyond today in America, especially the Emile.
That was great. I have a follow-up question. Was there a religious or moral objection to thinkers like Hobbes coming from the American founding?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. The Americans thought of Hobbes as a relativist or a nihilist. Hobbes, for example, denies that there's such a thing as justice by nature, that is, there's no natural justice. And the Americans were, for the most part, committed in one form or another to a theory of natural justice, which is what theory of natural rights is, a theory of natural justice. And Hobbes has a theory of natural right, but his theory of natural right goes like this. In the state of nature where the natural right is present, every man has a right to everything, including one another's bodies. The Americans just didn't They didn't accept that. That was not, from their point of view, a morally acceptable. It wasn't even a moral position at all, much less morally acceptable. And they thought that that was all related to Hobbes's atheism, or they interpreted Hobbes very much to be an atheist, which is a contested position. There are some scholars out there who think Hobbes was indeed a very unorthodox, but some sort of Christian, in fact. But that, by the by, the Americans didn't read him that way.
One of the phrases used about Hobbes in his era and afterward is he is the beast of Malmesbury because he's an atheist. There's no way to fit his philosophical principles with a view that there is a benevolent creator that has ordered not only the cosmos, but human life with these natural laws and natural rights. So the Americans are not disposed toward this view.
Given the emphasis of separation of church and state in our founding spirit, why would the founders care whether a thinker was essentially godless or God-fearing or not?
I would say there's a phrase that Michael Zuckert has used in his scholarship about the American founding, that it is an amalgam of ideas. There are some ideas clearly more important than others, and Michael's clearly of the view that Locke, you know, fundamentally more important than some other influences. But it would be a mistake to say, well, Locke is important and he's the exclusively important figure. So Enlightenment philosophy generally is not the exclusive influence on the legal and political and constitutional thinking of the American founders. So Christianity, particularly in its Protestant version, but in a broader, more complicated way. And I would say the natural right and even natural law dimension coming from European philosophy is important to the Americans. So this the opening reference in the Declaration of Independence to these principles is the laws of nature and nature's God. Before there's a reference to self-evident rights of individuals, the broad phrase is the laws of nature and nature's God. And then, not from Jefferson's pen, but from the Continental Congress debating Jefferson's draft, come these later references in the Declaration of Independence to a divinity, never named as specifically Christian or even biblical, but a divinity who is providential and cares for human affairs. So there are two references appealing to the supreme judge of the world for the rectitude of our intentions and appealing to the protection of divine providence. This is all the same set of Americans, American leaders and American statesmen, who, if you look at those four references to divinity, you can see Michael's amalgam argument there. The Americans are not at all allergic to the idea of borrowing from, being influenced by, a range of intellectual and religious sources. Well, Michael didn't have any commentary on that. He just let me go. Surprised you let me get away with that.
What you were saying was okay. It was fine.
Okay.
Fine by me. Anyway, yeah, it sounded perfect.
So okay. Something I don't know that we touched on earlier was painting a picture of the philosophical climate at the time, right before the founding. So can you talk a bit about, you know, who were the famous philosophers at the time of the founding, and what was the conversation going on at the time of our founding fathers? And also, how did they interact, or how did they learn about these philosophers? Were they taught about Hobbes in college? How did they encounter the works of these philosophers we're talking about?
Oh, man, Samantha, that's like a huge question. So, okay, I mean, I'll start with something on that. So the American Revolution, while it was indeed a democratic movement, it still had a leadership, which we, I think, would have to say was an elite leadership. So most of the leaders of the Americans were well-educated people. There was an effort in America to establish good educational, higher educational institutions, really, well, not from the very start, but early on. So A lot of them went to Harvard or William and Mary, or like Madison went to Princeton. They got a good education. They read the chief philosophy of the time. And that would have included reading Locke. That would have included reading Montesquieu. I don't know if they read that as much in college, because he was newer. Montesquieu's Spirit of the Laws had been published in 1748. So it was fairly new at the time that they were all being educated. I don't know if Hobbes would have been assigned as an assigned reading in their colleges, but many of them knew about him. Though we have to say, it was, as was the case with many other thinkers, they knew about him more than they knew him. So I wonder how many of them actually read Hobbes, as opposed to had heard that he was an atheist and an absolutist and a immoralist and a nihilist and all of these bad things. So it's not clear how much they had read him. People like Jefferson, who read very widely on their own, Adams, who read everything that had been written up to that time, these people would have read him without question. But whether the run-of-the-mill elite founders would have, it's less clear, I think. So what were the major intellectual movements of the time? Well, Locke's essay on human understanding was a very major text. For example, we have evidence that George Washington was reading Locke's essay on understanding. And it's difficult to imagine our president, our current president, or any president of recent history reading some of the major philosophic works of the day. But there was George Washington reading Locke's essay on human understanding. So that he was a very important thinker. Other thinkers who were important, some of the major ones in the canon, Bacon, for example, was somebody who was read at the time. But there was another school of thought that was very influential in America at the time that we haven't really touched on. And that was the so-called Scottish Enlightenment. There was a series of writers who grew up in Scotland who had a big impact on the Americans. One of the reasons being that for some reason, a lot of the teachers who came to America from Europe were in fact Scottish and were trained up in the Scottish Enlightenment. So that somebody like Jefferson was educated by somebody who was a Scottish a devotee of the Scottish Enlightenment. Madison was educated at Princeton, and the president of Princeton at that time was a devotee of the Scottish Enlightenment. James Wilson, another very important founding era period person, was very influenced by the Scottish Enlightenment thinking. So that was another kind of thought. Now, Scottish Enlightenment thinking was in some ways built on Lockean epistemology, but with regard to morals, it took a somewhat different approach. However, with regard to politics, interestingly, the chief Scottish Enlightenment thinker who was important for the Americans was a fellow named Hutchinson. And Hutchinson's political philosophy was actually pretty much identical to Locke's. So it didn't have a difference with regard to politics per se, but it did have a somewhat different position with regard to morality. The Scottish Enlightenment philosophy with regard to morality was something called the moral sense position. The moral sense position: we have a moral sense that we can, with which we can perceive moral relations, just as we can perceive colors with our eyes. This is a position that many Americans found, how should we say, consoling morally satisfying.
That's interesting. Very helpful that Michael brought up the Scottish Enlightenment. To mention David Hume as well, it seems to have had some influence on Madison, but also Adam Smith. Most Americans would think of Adam Smith as only an economic thinker. His hugely important book from 1776, the short title of which is The Wealth of Nations. But Smith was a Scottish Enlightenment, a professor of moral philosophy, and his first book was in this moral sense school of thinking, the title of which was The Theory of Moral Sentiments. And Smith saw no tension or contradiction between these two books, his economic thinking, so to speak, and his moral sense philosophy, because he produced a final edition of The Theory of Moral Sentiments after he had published the Wealth of Nations. So, but I want to mention something from an American observing the influence of Enlightenment philosophy, European philosophy, on the Americans, writing just at the moment of success of the American Revolution in 1783, that they have defeated perhaps the most powerful empire in the world, and they are now independent. And this very public letter says the following: "The foundation of our empire was not laid in the gloomy age of ignorance and superstition, but at an epoch when the rights of mankind were better understood and more clearly defined than at any former period." And this tribute to the influence of philosophy on the American founding comes from none other than George Washington in his circular letter to the states and all the governors in 1783, a person who did not have a college education, but had already by that time surrounded himself, knew he needed to surround himself with very smart people, one of which was Alexander Hamilton. So the influence of philosophical ideas circulating, even to someone like Washington, a very busy sort of executive type person, farmer, planter, and then general, these ideas are penetrating. I do want to say one thing about Montesquieu, though. We do have some evidence that the Spirit of Laws is a text of political science or philosophy. So Michael mentioned the Reverend Witherspoon, who's the president of the College of New Jersey, we now call Princeton. Madison is reading Montesquieu then, and Hamilton, we know, did. Jefferson, we have handwritten notes or, you know, passages from the Spirit of Laws that Jefferson wrote out and copied from 29 of the 31 long books of the Spirit of Laws. So it is definitely in the it's in the water, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. It's being read, but Jefferson, for example, didn't read it in college. He read it on his own, but yeah,
read it later.
Being read. I didn't mean to suggest it wasn't being read. It just wasn't sure it was a textbook in the colleges.
Yeah, so you've mentioned a lot of really interesting philosophical movements and thinkers. Are there any more obscure philosophers in the mind of the founders that we haven't covered yet that might be interesting to touch on?
Well, there's one of my favorites, actually, is this fellow Delhomme, who was a Swiss thinker who moved to England and wrote a very, at that time, very well-known book on the British Constitution. He was influenced by Montesquieu, in fact, but he tried to modify Montesquieu a little bit, simplify him, actually. So I'm always impressed by the fact that John Adams, who wrote a very voluminous book about the American constitutions, John Adams said when he came to discuss the British Constitution, said, well, the British Constitution, after Delhomme, there's nothing more to be said about it. He seemed to think that Delhomme was a greater expert on the British Constitution than was Montesquieu. So he was one of the people, now rather obscure, but at the time of the founding, actually fairly widely read. He was in the top 10 of people cited by the American founders, period. Go ahead.
Yeah. No, go ahead.
I was just going to say another person of some influence, Vattel, a thinker.
I was just going to mention the international, right?
Yeah,
the Right of Nations thinkers.
Yeah.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say Vattel wrote mostly on the Law of Nations, international relations, and he was of some impact on them, especially in that area. Berlamaki, he was another one who had some influence, sometimes, in my opinion, overstated, but nonetheless, he did have some impact.
In that Farmer refuted letter that from Hamilton in 1775, invoking right of nature, natural rights philosophers, he does list two of these, three of these right of nations, or we would think of them as international law thinkers. So Burlamaqui is one, but Grotius is another, and Pufendorf. And Montesquieu cites Grotius and Pufendorf for influence. So this is an interesting dimension. In Article 1 of the Constitution, under the powers that Congress has, there's a phrase, the law of nations. And these are the kinds of philosophers, Vattel, Burlamaqui, Grotius, Pufendorf, who certain of the Americans would have read and known as they're trying to apply what jurists about war and peace, are there rights and laws governing war and peace? What these European thinkers had developed over centuries, trying to apply that to the new independent American context.
My particular favorite, Pufendorf, out of that list. He was actually interestingly an influence on Locke. Pufendorf, in philosophical circles, was known as somebody who had developed an important critique of Hobbes. One of the things he had tried to show was that Hobbes's conception of rights was completely mistaken. And that, I think, did have an impact on Locke.
Interesting.
Can you summarize, now that we've gone over basically the philosophical gamut of the thinkers in the minds of the founders, can you give an elevator pitch as to why, generally speaking, broad strokes, they went with Locke and Montesquieu above all others?
Locke and Montesquieu, I think, spoke to their needs more clearly than any of the others. I mean, their one need of having, in the first case, a defense of rationale for their vision of what the relationship between their governance and British governance was, that Locke, as they interpreted him, supported that philosophically better than anybody else. And I think when it came to constitution making, Montesquieu was the one who's more helpful to them. Paul, maybe you can expand on that a bit.
Yeah, the Americans in the 1760s and 1770s, when the tensions first arise with Britain, have experienced, practiced a culture of political liberty, ordered constitutional legal political liberty for a very long time. And then they are able to turn to philosophers for arguments explaining what exactly is this grievance that we have with the English Parliament and the English King. And Locke's very clear statements about these questions of what is legitimate authority and what it really is liberty and what are rights of individuals. So there are phrases from the common law they can draw on, but as the conflict deepens and bloodshed is occurring, the striking quality, the clear kind of declarative quality of Locke's philosophy is so appealing to say that this is not legitimate government, this is not legitimate authority, what we're dealing with here. This is a kind of tyranny. And then yes, as the revolution is successful and they have the challenge of building constitutions, they want, it's in the American political culture, they want constitutions. So during the war, they're writing state constitutions. And then they have the Confederation Congress writing an Articles of Confederation, which is something like a constitution. And as a consensus builds that there's a big problem, Articles are not quite working out the way they had hoped. They have Montesquieu and Blackstone to turn to. And especially more so Montesquieu, because there is a theoretical quality to his study of the English Constitution as a constitution of liberty. And there are these broader philosophical arguments in the Spirit of Laws about avoiding despotism and distributing power and seeking a balanced, complicated form of politics as the surest way to avoid despotism or illegitimate concentrations of power. So there he is as a resource that can be consulted, but also debated. You know, who's got the right reading of Montesquieu's counsel or advice.
So many philosophers, so little film time. Thank you, Professor Carice and Professor Zuckert, for joining me today. You can check out our film, The Philosophers Behind the Founders, on YouTube, Facebook, or on our website at fedsoc.org. That's FEDSOC.org. For more episodes, subscribe to the FedSoc Films podcast on your favorite platform. Thanks for listening. As always, the Federalist Society doesn't take any positions on the issues discussed.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.